Cool. Welcome, everybody, and thank you for coming. I'm here to talk about HA and DR in Linux Server 2013. Hope everyone's having an awesome first day in Tech Ed. Hands up if you're not from Spain. Everybody, so you're loving this weather, right? How warm is it here? I'm from Australia where the sunshine's quite good and everything, but I live in England where the weather's terrible. So I'm just I'm all out in the sunshine today. It's fantastic. Cool. Now, what I want to start off with is a bit of an eventful day in the life of a Link administrator where something like this might happen to your data center. And this is kind of like worst case scenario, right? Like a meteor hits your data center or something and you're completely offline, absolutely cactus. And your Link servers might look a bit like this. Well, they're probably a bit better frying kebabs over them than providing Link services to your user base. I think your first reaction is something like this, oh my God, what do I do? I'm completely offline. My CEO's come to me and said nobody can make phone calls anymore. And generally, this is a reaction that I would have had in a situation like this. I'd be pulling my hair out and be like, what am I going to do? And then you might think about doing this. It's like, no, that's it. I'm going home. I can't believe somebody's actually put together a diagram on this, because what's happened to somebody's life to be able to have to put this together? It's good. It's a wonder of the internet, right? And then you might think about doing this, and the worst case scenario is just completely end life and get rid of it. And then you sort of realize that one does simply not leave at 6 p.m. when things like this happen. So when we start looking at these problems, this is how I've been in the past, where I've been looking at, back in the day, Cisco Call Manager, and I've been sitting there just tearing my hair out, looking at a computer screen for 4 hours. And then after a while, I start to feel like this guy, and I just want to completely punch anything around me because I'm over it. And I'd throw this in there as well because I love The Office. Office Space, awesome movie. But then I think, hang on a second, I've deployed Link 2013, and I've got these awesome new HA and DR capabilities where I can fail over databases and I can pair my pools together and fail over pools, and then probably feel a bit more like this guy, a little bit more relieved. So I realized that, hey, my DC1's failed, but I've got a full Link environment in DC2 that is also active, but it's also scaled to support the users in DC1, so I can fail over that environment to that standby data center. And then what this leads to is a bunch of happy users and happy bosses, which is ultimately us as IT pros are there to serve our users and keep our management happy, a sort of two-pronged approach, with the ultimate outcome of keeping everyone open for business, revenue generating, lights on, that kind of thing. So as I said, welcome to Designing for High Availability and Disaster Recovery in Link Server 2013. My name's Justin Morris. I'm a Link MVP and Senior Consultant for Modality Systems. We're a UC specialist based out of London, UK and Seattle, Washington. Cool, so I've got a ton of stuff to cover today around HA and DR. What I want to talk about first and foremost is actually defining what HA and DR mean with Link Server 2013 as a product. And then I'm going to take a bit of a step back and talk about the story so far. So what was available in OCSR2, what was in Link 2010, and then start to dive straight into the Link 2013 changes, so front-end server architecture changes. And then I want to just take a bit of a sidestep, talk about hardware and DNS load balancing for a bit, because they are quite critical HA components. And then go into pull backend site resiliency features, the two biggest improvements that are in Link 2013. And I want to cover scenarios that are no longer supported, because these will impact quite a few people that have Link 2010 and OCSR2 deployed today. And then the second half of the session, we're going to cover file share, persistent chat, edge server, and branch office resiliency. And I'm going to wrap it all up with a couple of key takeaways that is good for everybody to know after you leave TechEd. Okay, so how do we define HA and DR in Link 2013? Really, I think high availability is something like it's a quick, usually automated recovery of an application or service. So I've got multiple Link front-end servers deployed, multiple mediation servers deployed, and they're there so there's an automated recovery of that service, and so it's not interrupted. And we ensure that each component within the same data center is resilient. So I've got no single point of failure. I've got N plus one redundancy. So there's not, you know, an SBC or gateway out there that's the single one of those within the enterprise that if that fails or like somebody cuts the network cable to that device, that could mean the end of voice functionality for my organization. So really HA is something that we build in by design into the environment to say, this is going to be completely resilient in every scenario within the same site. With disaster recovery with Link 2013, this is really something we activate only when things have really gone bad. So my primary data center is completely offline. Maybe the backup generator's gone, somebody's put an excavator through the exchange like that connects to that data center. We're completely on our own, basically. And really, this is not just a IT decision to make, but also a business decision, because you might have a standby office or something there that you would move all your users to work from as well. So it's an IT and business decision process to make to say, yes, we're going to activate our disaster recovery process and completely forklift the business into a DR mode, essentially. And usually when DR is activated, it's to the outside of the primary data center, so we've got something completely standby for that. Okay, so we've covered really like the theoretical design-based sort of stuff. What about the story so far? So what did we have before Link 2013 in terms of HA and DR capabilities? So in OCS 2007 R2, we had the concept of the Enterprise Edition pool, which is kind of like, you know, the most consistent thing as we go back through the product line from today all the way back to LCS 2005 days. With the concept of the Enterprise Edition pool with multiple front-end servers and multiple back-end servers, generally in a SQL cluster, that provide that complete resiliency for both pieces of the puzzle. And then there was the Metropolitan Site Resiliency solution, which provided us with both HA and DR in some senses, in that it was completely available in the event of any component failing, but it also represented an element of DR because it was stretched across sites. And I'm going to cover that in a bit more detail in the next slide. But then finally, recovering from backup was really most organizations' only real option. So if you had a standard edition server or an enterprise pool, there wasn't much you could do other than keeping a backup of your SQL databases and file share and settings and that kind of thing to be able to recover in the event of disaster. And then moving on to Link Server 2010, things did start to get a little bit better. The Enterprise Edition pool is maintained there, and the Metropolitan Site Resiliency solution is still there. But Link 2010 introduced the concept of the backup registrar. And what this really was providing voice resiliency as the priority. So we didn't user features, so like presence and contactless and things were kind of lost in the event of failure, but Link 2010 with the backup registrar capability allowed you to say, I've got pool one here and pool two here, make those backup registrars for each other so that if pool one fails, pool two will do all the voice routing for users that were on pool one. So that Microsoft designed in Link 2010 to say that in the event of anything happening, always provide dial tone so that users could still make calls out. And because that was something that, you know, there was, you know, competing with PBXs and things like this, this was really the priority within that product's timeframe. As I said, restoring non-voice workloads required recovering from backup. So you still had to have your databases restored there and have maybe a pool standby ready to go to restore into if you considered things like IAM and presence and conferencing as critical workloads that needed to be available. So what did that Metropolitan Site Resiliency solution look like? Well, it looked like this. And as you can see, I've got a load of infrastructure there all supporting this environment. And the requirements were you needed two data centers and you needed essentially a mirror of your entire infrastructure across both. You needed 20 milliseconds network latency between the two and a gigabit bandwidth. So effectively, this solution is for companies that have two data centers in the same metro area, so in the same city, they've maybe got an east data center and a west data center. You could have set up this Metropolitan Site Resiliency solution for that and provided full HA and DR for Link. So it really was a bit of a holy grail, like it was quite awesome. I know just a couple of companies that have this deployed and it works really well for them. one of the things that was like the SQL cluster and SAN replication requirements there was you needed quite a hefty sort of requirement to get this up and running. So you needed complete kind of cooperation from all the IT teams. And when I've tried to troubleshoot environments like this, we've literally had like a big war room full of people in setting this up. So networking people, hardware load balancing people, SQL people, trying to work out where the problem was. So it was great from an architecture perspective, but the overhead was quite high to maintain this. Okay, so let's start to talk about what are the actual Link 2013 changes, what's new. And we'll start with the front-end server architecture, because this is really where there's been some quite radical and significant changes. The front-end pool architecture in Link Server 2010 looked like this. We had front-end servers and back-end servers, and they were quite tightly coupled. So whenever I made a contact list change, if I went into a meeting and my presence goes from available to in a meeting, the first thing that happens is my client goes off and tells the front-end server, change my status, and then change it in the RTC Dyn database. So I'm making a write into that database, and then everybody that has me on the contact list is doing a read as well. So we're literally hammering that database like constantly. And it was really a centralized design, so the front ends and SQL databases were very tightly coupled. And in Link 2010, the front end servers were kind of a little bit dumb. So they sort of like, if you had a front end server failure, you could just like drop it, start it back up. Front end servers would connect to the SQL instance, and it'd be completely fine. You know, there wasn't any issues with that. So because all the user data was in SQL, all the transactions had to be committed. So conferencing, presence, contact list, all that kind of thing, it was all in backend SQL. So that's where the real bottleneck was. And because of that bottleneck, there was a hard limit of 10 front-end servers in your pool. So if you had a requirement for a pool of, you know, in excess of the number of users 10 front-end servers can support, you had no choice but to deploy a completely separate pool to support that number of users. So the scalability was quite limited in Link 2010. But now, if you look at Link 2013, everything is quite different. So now, all the dynamic data is handled by the front-end servers, and they're very much kind of decoupled now. So the user and presence data is now stored on the front-end servers. They have a lot more SQL databases sitting on them, and they're storing all the contact lists and conferencing information for users that are homed on that front-end server. And how this works is users are automatically mapped to user groups, and then each of those user groups is dynamically assigned to three front-end servers within the pool, a primary, a secondary, and a tertiary. And so if you've got a set of users that are homed on FE1, the databases that are on FE1 have all the user data for those users, so their contact list, presence, information is all stored dynamically, and their conference information. Got a photo? Good. So all user that's in the local RTC local database is on those three front-end servers, and it's replicated using Windows Fabric. So it made more sense for Microsoft to utilize an existing replication technology that was also a Microsoft product and go out and build something themselves that was bespoke to Link. So if you think of the front-end server, it's kind of a unit here, and then Windows Fabric runs underneath all of that across all of your front-end servers and replicates all that user data across all the front-end servers. So what happens is a sync agent backs up data from the RTC local database on the FEs and then puts in the RTC XDS blob store in the back end every 30 seconds. So this is what reduces our dependency on the back end SQL server, is we're doing these sort of lazy writes now. So that the purpose of this is to just keep the back end up to date in the event that all the front ends go down, because the back end is essentially our last resort, like authoritative source of data, so that we're always keeping that up to date, but we're not so concerned about the I/O and what the performance is on that. As long as we get that data in there, then it's all good, and then it means we can recover in the event of some sort of complete front-end failure or a startup on first time. So what this all means is far less dependency on back-end SQL. And I think as Link administrators, we like to have a lot more visibility of the environment as possible. You know, like, as great as what SQL DBAs are, it would be good that if we can completely see end-to-end visibility of our environment. Now, I want to talk about this concept of pool quorum. Now, for all nodes, need to be able to connect to 50% of the pool to be able to start. And as I said, the backend holds that quorum, so it's authoritative for the pool. And what this means is the recommended minimum number of front-end servers to be 3. And the thing with Quorum is that if 50% of the pool is down, Link essentially says that if we're under 50% of the pool, we don't have enough resources to support the user population, essentially. And what I've got here is a table that says, you know, if I have 3 or 4 front-end servers in my pool, then I need at least 2 of those servers to be functional for the front-end pool to remain active. Because what will happen is if you've got 4 servers in the pool and 2 go offline, 50% of the pool is only available, and the pool will shut itself down because it will just say, excuse me, haven't got the resources to maintain this, and shut it all down. And this is why people online have been saying that if they've got 2 front-end servers in their pool and 1 goes down, that they can't start it back up successfully, and then the other one stops itself. And like, there were people on the forum like just after the initial release of 2013 saying, what's going on? This is completely not how I expected it to happen. And then we started to learn more about the architecture and the Quorum, things like that. So what about if you've got today a front-end pool with 2 front-end servers? And I know loads of companies are running this completely fine on Link 2010 today, 2 front-end servers, SQL cluster in the back-end works fantastically. You can still maintain this in Link 2013, but it's good to understand there are a lot of caveats for this based on the pool Quorum situation. So if one of the 2 front-end servers goes down, you need to bring it up as soon as possible, because there's a grace period then before the other front end will realize that it's the only remaining front end server, 50% of the pool's down, and it shuts itself down as well. So it's quite a significant change. If you need to take both down at once, you need to plan this really carefully, because the front ends check the back end for startup order. And what there is a concept of a routing group. So if I've got FE1 and FE2, the back end database knows which one has to start up first for that routing group to be valid. So if FE1 goes down first and then I take down FE2, and I've taken them down in that order, if I don't take FE2 up and FE1 in the reverse, then the back end is going to complain and the front end servers won't start properly. So what we need to think about is, if you do this, you need to really have it in your mind and in the team that manages that environment, that if they're going to perform maintenance on those servers, they need to be very aware of it. But I think what I've been recommending to my customers is if that you traditionally would have architected a 2 front-end server pool, what you should do looking at is if you can't deploy the 3 front-end servers, probably because you know the number of users you have can't really justify the resources for that. That's 3 front-end servers, right? And especially with the hardware requirements for Link 2013 now, with like it's like hex core and 32 gig of RAM, you need 3 servers of that. That's going to be expensive. So you should consider just pairing 2 standard edition servers as an alternative, because it does provide manual HA, and I'll go into this in a bit further detail and tell you a bit more about how 2 standard edition servers can actually be quite a compelling solution. Okay, I want to talk a bit about hardware and DNS load balancing. And even though there's not really been any there hasn't been any changes in Link 2013 around hardware and DNS load balancing. One about cookie persistence, actually. But I think it's good to just rehash this and cover this, because it's something that it's good to understand from top to bottom in terms of architecture of the front-end pool. Because you know it's good to understand front-end and back-end relationships, but sometimes, especially myself, I forget that I've got load balancing in front of that, and that's what's actually critical for client connectivity. So what this gives us is it provides node-level resiliency. So I've got my, you know, however many it is, 4 front-end servers within the pool, but they don't do anything unless I've got something to send the connections to that, so point the clients to the front-end servers. And DNS load balancing gives us that in the sense that clients log in for the first time and they cache IP addresses of the front-end servers. And this is introduced in Link Server 2010 to sort of take away a bit of the dependency on hardware load balancing. And DNS load balancing in Link 2013 will load balance all your SIP and media traffic for your front-end, director, edge, and mediation server pools. And the way this is configured is within DNS, you would have an FQDN of, say, like espool2.contoso.com, And then that would have, you know, however many IP addresses that correspond to the front end servers within DNS. And that's how we achieve DNS load balancing. So as I said, hardware load balancing, traditionally a pain point for Link deployments, where I would go in and talk to people that manage the hardware load balances in an environment and say, okay, I need to load balance port 443, port 80, but also 5061, 5062, 3478, and all these media ports and all these other things. And these guys look at me like, well, hang on, I just load balance web traffic, man. Just give me a break. And so this is a real pain point for Link deployments because it was blocking large-scale deployments of big enterprise pools. But we haven't completely gotten away from hardware load balancing. It is still required for front-end and direct-to-web traffic. A new requirement within Link Server 2013 is the Office Web Apps Farm that provides enhanced PowerPoint functionality within the Link 2013 client. If you deploy two of those in a farm, you still need to hardware load balance those as well, because that's just web traffic. And lastly, HLB, still required if you need to provide backwards compatibility with OCS or Exchange 2010 Unified Messaging pre-SP1. Now, these products they don't understand DNS load balancing, so when they connect to a link pool, they don't cache the IP addresses of that pool. They just find one IP and stick to it. So if the IP they're connected to fails, they're not intelligent enough to renegotiate the connection. Also, if you've got any questions, just chime in or leave them to the end. Like, I'm pretty easy on this kind of thing. Question over here? Cool. So the question was, hardware load balancing required for Office Web Apps Farm, and is DNS load balancing not supported? The answer is yes. DNS load balancing is not supported for Office Web Apps Farm. Cool. Okay, we've covered all the front end side of things, and I've covered hardware load balancing. Now I'll talk about some cool stuff around the back end resiliency features that have been introduced in Link 2013. So first and foremost, bang, SQL mirroring, now supported. When I saw this, like, and it was first presented to me in a document, I was like, amazing, because I'd had some exposure to Link and SQL mirroring in the past where a customer told me, you know, I want to get this to work, can you tell me why this doesn't work? And so I set up a lab environment with a two-node SQL mirror and I think a two or three front-end Link 2010 pool, and failed over to the mirror node, and everything just stopped working. Like, Link 2010 front-end servers stopped their front-end services or just hung, and when I restarted the front-end service, they wouldn't connect to the other node because the SQL native client that sits underneath the Link 2010 front-end server has no understanding of the mirror endpoint, so the other SQL server. Because within Link 2010 topology builder, you only assign one SQL server FQDN, so there's no option to tell it what the mirror is, right? And even if I did things like change DNS to point to the IP of the mirror SQL node, still wouldn't connect. Like, and I tried all these measures to try and get the Link front end to talk to the SQL mirror. It was just absolutely not happening at all. And in the end, the only way I got it to work was I changed the computer name of the mirror node to get this to work. So I think that's a pretty extreme thing to have to do to utilize mirroring. So when I heard that mirroring was supported in Link 2013, I was like, good stuff. And the way this is used is, it's pretty vanilla in terms of SQL mirroring. So Link uses a principal and a mirror node, and those are in an active-passive configuration. And really, you would deploy SQL database mirroring in an insight deployment only, and you can't stretch these across data centers. So when I first saw this, I'd be like, oh, this would be fantastic to have DC1, DC2 stretched mirror across the two. Unfortunately, that's not supported. Okay, so the question was, is it not supported completely, or is it just that it sort of technically will work but isn't supported? Is that essentially the... Yeah.
Two data centers,
Okay, so the question was, could you just do this anyway? Would it technically work, essentially? Okay. The answer is yes. From a SQL perspective, it would still work. But the fact is, and in a later slide I'll explain, is that Metro data center site solution is deprecated. It's no longer supported. So if you had a SQL mirror stretched across two sites, that would form that part of the solution, and which isn't supported. So, cool. Okay, and really what I recommend for everybody to do when you deploy a SQL database mirror is to deploy an optional witness, because this will give you automatic failover in the event of the primary going offline. And I'll demo this in a later slide to show you just how quick it is, actually. So with this new pool backend resiliency feature, the target RTO is 5 minutes. So with this, you will get everything back up and running within 5 minutes and only lose 5 minutes worth of data. Okay, how does Link 2013 utilize SQL mirroring? It does it synchronously in high safety mode. And all databases, including the CMS, can be mirrored. So all of your RTC databases, persistent chat, archiving, monitoring, everything can be mirrored over to the passive node. But the thing to remember here is the principal and mirror servers must be the same version and edition of SQL Server. So I couldn't have principal running 2008 R2 and mirror running 2012, or I couldn't have standard and enterprise. They have to be both the same edition and both the same version. But the good thing here is that if you've got a witness deployed, you can utilize this for multiple pools. One caveat with this is that if you define a witness within one central site within Topology Builder, you need to then define it a second time in the second central site if that's where that additional pool is that you want to utilize the witness. It's a bit confusing straight up, but essentially you need to define the witness twice if they're in different sites. But the good thing is the witness can be a different version, including SQL Express, so it reduces the licensing requirement of this a little bit. Okay, how is SQL mirroring set up from a Link perspective? It's all deployed and configured within Link Server Topology Builder, and there's no configuration required in SQL Management Studio, which is great because it means that us as Link administrators can go out and install our mirror databases by ourselves using either Topology Builder or Management Shell. As you can see here within this screenshot, is that I've defined the primary SQL Server store, but then I've also enabled SQL Store mirroring and defined the FQDN for the mirror database, or the mirror server rather. And I've enabled the witness capability and specified the FQDN for the witness server as well. And when you go through and publish this topology, if it's publishing the front end pool for the first time, Topology Builder will go off, find those two SQL servers, deploy the databases in the primary, and then deploy the databases in the mirror and set up all the mirroring for you. So you don't even need to touch Management Studio, which is great. So we can say SQL guys don't need you anymore. Cool. Yeah, the question was, do you need special SQL rights to be able to do this? And the answer is yes, you need sysadmin to be able to do this. Okay, the question was, do I have to use Topology Builder to do this, or can I do it manually? You don't have to use Topology Builder. You can use Management Shell to do this, but you can't set it up manually. Link has to go and actually configure the mirroring itself. And what I will touch on in another slide is about mirroring endpoint ownership as well, which is quite important. The good thing about this as well is you can configure it after your initial deployment. Sorry, question? Sorry, I can't hear you. Yeah, so the question was, cluster's not supported. The answer is yes, and I'll go into that in a future slide. Great, so this can be configured after your initial deployment. So you could say, if for whatever reason you don't have the resources available to deploy your complete mirroring configuration from day one when you deploy Link, you could just set up a standalone SQL server initially, deploy the databases to that, and begin providing service to your users if you wanted to, and then when the resources become available down the track, set up the mirroring SQL server store, go back into Topology Builder and configure that mirroring relationship. So there's a bit of flexibility there. Okay, now I want to talk about this mirroring endpoint ownership that can be an issue within lockdown SQL environments. So when you set up database mirroring, what Link will do is go off and create the mirroring endpoints on each SQL server, and it will use port 5022 by default. And what this does is sets up all the SQL mirroring and enables a TCP port for that that synchronization. And what happens is the account that you use to set that up becomes the endpoint, the owner of the endpoint in SQL. So if you set up a dedicated temporary Link admin account to do this, and then the consultant that does that goes off site, and then you disable or remove their account later on down the track, the mirroring will stop working because that account is no longer active in AD. So a way around this is to have your SQL team create the mirroring endpoints in advance. And that kind of touches on the question you had about can I set this up manually, is that it is still worth, if you've got a lockdown environment and you're doing this in the scenario I mentioned, having the SQL DBAs involved to pre-configure that mirroring endpoint. Okay, so what do things like look like if we fail over a mirrored database? You can control this on a per database type basis. So you could say just fail over the user databases or just fail over the application databases, like the call park service database or response group database or CMS as well. So there's some granularity there. Now, if this happens and it's unplanned and you have a witness deployed, you can pretty much sit back and relax because the witness takes care of the failover, activates the mirror node as the principal, and everything keeps on running. Front-end services are happy. But if you don't have a witness required, it is going to require some manual intervention. And the first thing you need to do is check which server currently hosts the databases, because there could be some inconsistency there based on some blips in the network in the past, something like that. And then you need to invoke a manual failover of the user, CMS, and application databases. Now, these are the commandlets that you need to use to fail over a mirrored database. That first one there is get-cs database mirror state, and then I specify the pool fkdn. And then what this does is returns a list of all my SQL databases for that pool and which of the principal or mirror has ownership of the database at this point in time and what the health of the synchronization is. And then I'll run those three commandlets after that that actually invoke the database failover, but I'll do that for each database type, so user, application, and central management. So if we look at this from a diagram perspective, this is what backend server failover would look like before. I've got my front-end servers connected to the principal node, and the mirror node is up to date with the database state. And the after scenario would look like this, where if I've got a witness supported, the witness deployed, the witness detects that the principal node's failed and fails over the databases to the mirror node, and the front-end servers detect that failure automatically and redirect their connectivity to the mirror node. But without that witness, you must manually invoke the failover, like I mentioned. Okay, if a backend server fails, user experience looks like this. The witness is configured, the failover happens automatically, and users won't see any change in service whatsoever. They won't notice it. But if no witness is configured, then you have to manually invoke the failover. The sessions will continue for about 30 minutes until the client realizes that the backend is unavailable, at which point Link will go into resiliency mode, so that limited functionality mode. And this is because the front-end servers do that lazy write every 30 minutes into the backend, and when the front-ends go, oh, hang on, backend's not up anymore, but the client then goes, oh, hang on, front-end can't connect to the backend, and then it all starts to cascade and stop working. So if you wanted to fail back a mirrored database in the event of unplanned failure, you would essentially use the same commandlets again, but the new principal switch, you would specify primary. Any question? Yes,
if you fail over with the witness, what happens to response groups?
Cool. And the question was, if you fail over with the witness, what happens to response groups? My understanding is that there's no interruption. So no, the current calls won't fail. Because the database is still available, it's effectively, there may be, if I would say if one call is coming in exactly as that database fails over, then it potentially might fail. But it should be pretty low. Yeah, if you have to manually fail over, once that RGS database is offline, then response groups would stop functioning. Cool. All right, why backend database mirroring rocks? What this does is make SQL database and server maintenance easy. So if your primary node, you need to take it offline to replace a disk or do Windows updates, something like that, you as a link administrator can just do a invoke -cs database failover to your mirror node, and do whatever you like on that principal node. It provides us with more monitoring and management of the database failover and failback, and it's completely owned by link admins. So no longer do I need to call up a DBA and say, can you fail over the cluster that my link databases are on? This also removes our dependency on shared storage. So you could have dedicated storage on the principal node, dedicated on the passive, and those don't need to be shared. They're completely independent from one another. Now, I want to talk a bit about SQL 2012 Always On and the deprecation of database mirroring in SQL 2012. This is a question that came up at TechEd North America. And Scott Stubblefield answered this and said that the reason that Link 2013 doesn't support Always On is because the product group didn't want to develop Link 2013 to use a HA technology that was so far ahead of everybody else. So they probably could have done it, but it would have locked out everybody that didn't have SQL 2012. They wouldn't have had any kind of database HA because they would have only been able to engineer for one resiliency technology. So Microsoft acknowledges that, but that's the explanation for why Always On isn't used. Okay, question was, can I use SQL Server 2014? And the answer is not yet, not today. maybe soon. That's quite forward thinking of you, but unfortunately not. All right, I want to demo this SQL database mirroring because it's always good to see something in the flesh. So what I have here is I've got a front-end server which is within this Paris site here. And I've got pool01.ls2013.com deployed. And what you can see is under associations, I've got my SQL Server Store as SQL01. And then the mirroring SQL Server Store is SQL02. And the SQL Server Witness is SQLW. So I've got all three stores defined there within Topology Builder, like I said. And when I published this for the first time, Topology Builder went out, provisioned the databases for me, set up the mirroring relationship, and there was quite a low touch on my side. So what I want to do is make a failover. Cool. So the first thing I'm going to do is get my database mirror state for the pool to just check which node owns the databases. Okay, extend that down a bit. Great, so we can see that our state on primary is principal for all the databases for this pool. So we're essentially good to go. The mirroring status on primary and mirror is all synchronized, so everything looks green. So what I'm going to do is invoke a controlled database failover for this pool. Specify my pool FQDN. And then I specify database type, so I'm going to do user first. New principal or primary. Oh, got that wrong. confirm that. And Link now goes off and says, SQL, make the mirror node owner for the user databases. Great, so we can see the failover result for that has been successful. And I could repeat this for the application databases as well, if I wanted to, and also monitoring and archiving. So what I want to demonstrate is on SQL over here, if I do a refresh of Management Studio, the three RTC databases are all now the mirror on the SQL 01. And if I go to SQL 02, and do a refresh over here, I can now see that the RTC databases are being hosted from SQL 02 now. Great, so this is all well and good if I wanted to run maintenance on SQL 01, but what happens if SQL 01 completely dies, right? Like the host that it on goes offline or the disks that are connected to it die or something like that. What would happen if that happened? And I'm going to simulate that. I'm going to stop this. So there we go. My primary SQL server is completely offline now. And what I can do is if I refresh Management Studio, I've got the witness deployed. Give that a couple of seconds. Great. So now I can see that all the databases are all set to principal. They're disconnected because the primary node is offline, but all those databases are completely up and running. And if I rerun my get CS database mirror state, Link will report what we've seen in Management Studio. Cool, so we can see state on mirror is principal, and we've lost connectivity to the primary. Cool, so pretty cool, right? You can see the health of all the databases now. I think this is quite a good feature. Lovely. Any questions on pool backend resiliency before I move on to site resiliency? Question down here. Okay, so the question was, with SQL mirroring not being supported across two data centers, could you get around this by having one central site defined but being in two physical locations? Is that the question? Okay. You could. There's nothing stopping that. I mean, Link doesn't have any awareness of the subnets that the servers are in. It just knows the FKDNs within Topology Builder. So Topology Builder wouldn't stop you doing that. It's just from a Microsoft supportability perspective that wouldn't be supported. So if you had a problem with your environment and you called support, and they validated that that's how it was set up, then you would probably need to revert to a supported scenario. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Any other questions before we move on? Nope. Cool. Okay, new site resiliency features. This is something I think is quite good as well, because it really ups the ante in terms of disaster recovery in 2013 and gives us a lot more flexibility. It kind of... It takes away with one hand and gives with another in terms of the metropolitan site resiliency solution, but it gives you a lot more flexibility and the ability to stretch across greater geographical distances. So we have this concept of front-end pool pairing and provides full disaster recovery of linked functionality across your data centers. So this is everything from end-to-end, so IAM in presence, conferencing, voice, response groups, call park, like you name it pretty much, persistent chat as well is all supported. And the user data is shared across both front-end pools. The guidance for this is that paired pools should be located in the same world region, so both in North America or both in Europe. There's nothing stopping you from putting two pools on opposite sides of the planet, but what you need to think about is the latency between those two pools. Now, the replication within day-to-day of those two paired pools won't really impact that. It's just about... if you fail over the pool pair to, say you've got users in New York and you've configured a pool pair over to a pool in London, if you invoke that failover, you've then got users coming from New York over the WAN to London, and their user experience could be impacted with that. So that's why the guidance is only deployed within the same world region. And the way this is achieved is that on each front-end server, an additional service called the backup service is installed, and this replicates the user data between each front-end that you've configured as the pool pair. And the way that it does this is that the backup service on each front-end server writes from the RTC XDS store into the pool's file share, and then what the other pool will do is look for changes in the file share of the pool that it's paired with and pull all that data into its own pool and then write that primary pool user data into its RTC local database within the front ends on the other pool. So you've got pool one and pool two. Both pools have a file share. What the backup service does is writes data into the file share, and then the file shares are replicated to each other, and then they're written back into the databases on each end. So it's kind of like a synchronous replication utilizing the file shares. Once again, in terms of same version requirements, pair only two pools of the same version, so enterprise and enterprise, and standard and standard. Now, the topology builder, it won't stop you from pairing an enterprise edition pool with a standard edition pool, I don't believe, but it's just not best practice because of like scaling, right? Because you wouldn't put the amount of users on enterprise pool could be like 50,000, and the number of users on a standard edition pool could be 5,000. So if you fail over a 50,000 user pool from enterprise to a 5,000 user standard edition server, it's gonna max out and die essentially. And this leads me on to the requirement for physical with physical, virtual with virtual. So we've got complete parity between the two of them, so that in the event of pool one that's paired to pool two failing, pool two has all the same capabilities as pool one to service that entire user population. And the best practice is to size each of these pools to take the load of both. So if you have 10,000 users in Paris and 10,000 users in Madrid, if you wanted to pair those two pools together, you would need to scale them to support 20,000 users on both. So you've got all the capacity in the event of disaster recovery. And our RTO RPO for front-end pool pairing is 30 minutes. So the objective here is to be able to recover within 30 minutes and only lose 30 minutes worth of data. So I think it's pretty good. You know, like a lot of companies I speak to and they say, oh, our DR RTO is like 2 days. And so if I can recover a Link front-end pool in 30 minutes, I think that's fairly impressive. Okay, what does the user experience look like during the actual pool failover? So the clients are logged out in the first time. The user experience can't be maintained where it's completely transparent, unfortunately. And the users can't log back in until the failover is invoked by the admin. So if I'm logged into pool 01 and pool 01 fails, the clients will be logged out and they won't be able to log back in until the failover is invoked using PowerShell to failover to pool 02. And then once that failover is invoked, clients will be in resiliency mode until that failover is completed. And I'll demo this failover in a second and show you what it looks like from a management shell perspective. It gives you some insight into what's happening in the background. And then once failover is completed, clients recover from limited functionality mode. And you'll see in a second that they get all their contact lists back, presence is all okay, they can do everything they need to do. Okay, so I'm going to demonstrate with a pretty little picture here in that this is what things will look like before a pool failover is invoked. So all my users are connected to their primary pool, UK users are connecting to the UK pool, European users to the German pool, and the user data is being replicated between the two paired pools. So the backup service there is replicating all the data out of the front end's databases into the file share and then over to the other pool and into its local databases. So each pool always has an up-to-date copy of the other pool's data. And after the pool failover has occurred, what happens is the clients re-register with that backup pool, And they're not rehomed to the backup pool. Rather, they're temporarily serviced by the backup pool. So within control panel, you won't see the registrar pool change for a particular user. They'll just be serviced by that pool temporarily as part of this pool failover. Okay, so how do you invoke a pool failover? You need to use the invoke-cs pool failover commandlet and specify the pool FKDN of the pool you want to fail over. And if this pool has completely gone offline, as in it's unavailable, we've invoked disaster recovery for the business, specify a disaster mode switch. This process will take several minutes to complete, but it depends on the number of users. And this is because even though all the user data is over there in the backup pool, Link has to do what's called rehydration of routing groups. So it needs to take that user data and tell the backup pool, you now need to be active for all of this user data. So if you have 20,000 users replicated to another pool, that's 20,000 users that has to go through and rehydrate the routing groups. So it can take a while to complete this process. And it's the same commandlet for failover and failback. Now, when you'd recovered the original pool, so say you'd rebuilt the servers, it was back up online, or maybe you'd be able to restore something. However, the pool has been made available again, the pool failback is going to take longer because all that user data needs to be backed up in the first instance to the primary pool again, because the backup service wouldn't have been running, so all the user data is not up to date on that recovered pool. Okay, I want to talk a bit about what the backup service does. I touched on it a bit before. It's installed by Deployment Wizard after the pool pair is created in Topology Builder. And you need to rerun Bootstrapper to install this. And as I said, it synchronizes all user and conference data between those paired pools. And this service will run on every front-end server within your front-end pool. Or if you've got a standard edition server, it'll just run the one standard edition server. And the command that's built into Link Server Management Shell to monitor and manage this. You can use get-cs backup service configuration to see how regularly the backup service is replicating the data to the other pool. And then you can make changes to that using the set commandlet as well. You can use the get-cs backup service status to find out how up-to-date the backup service is and the replication. Question? All right, cool. The question was, how is user data replicated between the front-end servers within the pool? That's the question? Great. The answer is, I covered that earlier about Windows Fabric with the primary, secondary, and tertiary nodes within a user group. So Windows Fabric replicates that user data across front-end servers. Cool. Great. And lastly, you can use a commandlet invoke-cs backup service sync. So if you're troubleshooting backup service synchronization, you can use this to invoke a synchronization. If you've ever used invoke, I think, CMS replication commandlet as well to give any servers that aren't replicating CMS a bit of a kick, this is a similar kind of commandlet. So like I said, backup agent writes from that RTC XDS database in the primary pool to its file share, and the data is copied to the backup pool. And the sync agent on that backup pool writes that data into the RTC local database on the front-end servers. So effectively, it sits there dormant, and it doesn't do anything until you invoke the pool failover. Okay, demo time again. Let's have a look at how this actually works from a Link perspective. I'm going to bring up my standard edition servers. SEO2, there it is. Excellent. So within Topology Builder here, I've got a Madrid central site and a London central site. And each of those have a standard edition server deployed within them. And I can see here, if I go to resiliency, JM-SEO1 has an associated backup pool of JM-SEO2. And if I click on that server, I can see that its resiliency in terms of associated backup pool is JM SEO1. So they're synchronously associated with each other for backup. Great. So what I'm going to do is this server here, JM SEO1, I'm going to fail over this to JM SEO2. I've got some clients here logged in. Okay, so we're going to specify invoke dash CS pool. Failover, specify my pool FKDN, JM SEO1. And execute that. Now what you'll see is that this command that actually does a whole other bunch of stuff under the covers, and it runs a number of different commandlets within itself. Confirm that. Great, so you can see it's getting CS registrar configuration to find out what the health is of the current pool that I'm failing over. And it gets itself into a steady state. So saying, check the health of both of these, are they ready to be failed over? Great. The first thing the commandlet's doing is getting the service status of the front-end service on this standard edition server. Now, this commandlet, what you could do is if you wanted to automate disaster recovery, you could build this into a PowerShell script and then potentially have a like a SCOM monitor set up to say, if all the services on this server fail, invoke this PowerShell script that then runs the invoke CS pool failover commandlet. So you could automate this if you wanted to, but Microsoft didn't build that into the product because they wanted to give administrators a chance to assess the situation and not just invoke this automatically like what happens with a SQL database mirroring with the witness deployed. My VMs are struggling. Look at them go. Okay, we'll see if any of these services have stopped yet. Nope, they're all up and running. If the primary pool is already offline, you would run this commandlet from the remaining pool to then go off, and it would verify the pool's offline and rehydrate the routing groups within the remaining pool. Cool, so we can see hydrating routing groups owned by JMSEO1. My client's been signed out. We've reset the CS pool registrar state on this pool FKDN to say that we're resetting the service. And there we go, client signed back in. So that was literally when I invoked that, like 5 seconds or something. Granted, I've only got 6 users on the pool, so it's not a 10,000 user deployment. But that user's now back online, and the failover is completed from a destination pool perspective. But now what Link's doing is, because the original pool was online, is it's going through and stopping the Link services for me. So within the services snap-in, I can see here that all my services are being stopped for me. So load test it. Cool. So the question is there a way to load test this? You could. I would say you could use the there's a stress and performance tool that enables you to provision a number of dummy users on your environment, and you could do the, you could provision those users as part of that tool and then invoke a pool failover. I think that would be, because using that tool, you can generate user traffic, like calls and IMs and things like that. So I think using conjunction with that tool, you could stress test it. Okay, I'm going to let that go because I've shown you how the client's recovered by itself there. Cool. So I think that's really cool. I think it's impressive. It's a great new feature within Link 2013. It gives us DR when we didn't have DR before for user services or IAM in presence and conferencing. We've now got it. Yep. Yeah, so the question was if is an organization that didn't have two. Right, okay, yeah. So the question was if you had a cold DR site that wasn't active and was just sitting there ready to go, would the recommendation be to deploy a standby link environment there? That's the recommendation would be that. So you'd have, if you had a completely architected front end pool within your active data center, you should have like for like deployed in your passive standby data center ready to go. Question on that? Okay, the question was, what happens to your voice routes for voice resiliency in the event of pool failover? The way you would design this would be to specify your link voice policies to have multiple PSTN usages in them that have a secondary route out of that local gateway that you've failed over to. So if I'd failed over from the Amsterdam pool to the Berlin pool, within the voice policy assigned to those Amsterdam users, we should have a secondary voice route for the Berlin voice gateways to ensure that those voice routes happen once they've been failed over. What happens is, what it will do is Link will, if the gateway's failed, so if the site is completely offline, then Link will mark those gateways as unavailable. So then it will send calls only to the remaining gateways that are within the voice policy. Cool. Okay, excellent. I've covered the database mirroring side of things. I've covered the pool failover side of things in site resiliency. Now I want to talk about scenarios that are no longer supported. So I touched on this a bit before. SQL clustering is no longer supported, and the path is to migrate to SQL mirroring. Now, if you've got SQL clustering today with Link 2010, you can maintain that in Link 2013. So you could migrate your Link 2010 pool with a cluster to a Link 2013 pool with a cluster. That is a supported scenario, but you should be looking to replace that with a mirror. However, if you've got OCS 2007 R2 with a cluster, you can't maintain that cluster onto a Link 2013 pool. It's only previous versions of Link Server, and that's explicitly detailed in TechNet documentation. And I appreciate that this is a bit of a sticking point for a couple of people, and happy to come and talk about it after the session as well and discuss, because I know the pain points and the questions and things. As I said, migrated Link 2010 pools can still use SQL clustering. Okay, the Metropolitan Site Resiliency solution is no longer supported, and the path is to migrate to front-end pool pairing. So if you do have this Metro Site Resiliency solution today, you need to be looking to move to the front-end pool pairing architecture for Link 2013. Yep. Okay. The question was, how would Link know if you're running this Metropolitan Data Center Resiliency model anyway? The question is that it doesn't. It literally has no understanding of your networking and storage and that kind of thing. It comes down to a supportability thing, really, in that if you deploy that on Link 2013 and maintain that solution and something goes completely wrong and you can't resolve it and you need to call Microsoft support, they're going to ask you how you got your environment deployed and verify everything. And if they find that you're in an unsupported scenario, that make you revert back to a supported scenario. So it's really, it's a, technically, you know, technically things work and that, and supportability scenarios and statements are issued by Microsoft because that's what they've tested. So if you talk about things like it's not supported, it doesn't mean it won't work. It just means it's not been tested and it's not supported by Microsoft. Like I mentioned sort of previous to the start of the session, the reason this is not supported is because of that quorum. So if one site completely fails, then only then 50% of the pool is gone, and then all front-end servers will realize that and shut themselves down. So there's no reason, like I said, that you couldn't do this technically. It's just that if one site fails, then that other site detects that, and it will shut everything down anyway. Okay, great. Let's cover some things around like general like auxiliary parts of the environment and how they're highly available. So DFS is supported within Link 2013, and replication is only supported within a single data center only. It's best effort. I can't say I've had a lot of success with DFS in the past. It can be a bit shaky, but I mean, other people might be running fine with it. So I would say give it a go, and then see how you go. And if it starts to become a bit flaky, then maybe revert to something a bit more dedicated. The clustered file server is still supported in this scenario, but I think my recommendation is keep a backup of the file share. I mean, you can't beat a backup at the end of the day, right? Because that's, you know, sort of that's your big chunk of data. Persistent chat resiliency. Okay. Who here is running group chat today within 2010 R2? One person, two person, three persons? Three people? Cool, that sounds about right in terms of how many people I've spoken to about group chat. I think this is good that persistent chat has been expanded in Link 2013 because it's such a great feature, but it was a real high barrier to entry previously. And so it's available now, and it's really valuable in terms of like for project teams and follow the sun and people like that. So I kind of like implore you to go and take a look at it. But from a resiliency perspective, it's another kettle of fish. It doesn't follow the pool pairing methodology that the front-end pool uses. You do need to stretch the persistent chat pool across sites. So I know you're looking at me and saying, but didn't you say I can't stretch a pool? This is the one exception to that rule. What you do is set up SQL mirror pair in one site and a backup database in the other using log shipping. So resiliency for persistent chat is definitely a whole other ball game in a lot of ways. This is somewhere where you'd probably need to keep the SQL DBA on side, so don't kick him out the door yet. I've got two topology options available to you for persistent chat resiliency. Two data centers with high bandwidth and low latency links, and two data centers with low bandwidth and high latency links. So essentially two different scenarios depending on your network layout. The high bandwidth, low latency topology would look like this, where I've got persistent chat SQL mirror set up in the primary side of New York and a backup in New Jersey there. And I'd have persistent chat servers active in both servers at once. So I've got two active in New York and two active in New Jersey, and clients are connecting to both of those. If I've got low bandwidth and high latency links between these two sites, what I would do is only have persistent chat servers in the New York site active at any one time and have the servers in New Jersey sitting dormant with their services stopped. Because when it comes to a persistent chat pool, you can only have four persistent chat servers active at any one time. So if you've adopted this topology, you'd have all four active in the primary site. If you adopted the previous topology, you'd have four but two in each site active. Okay, edge server resiliency. Really, this is a requirements gathering thing, so you need to determine what your HA requirements are for remote access, federation, and public IAM connectivity. Is it critical that you maintain remote user access in the event of this server failing, or is that something that you can accept and make a compromise on from a business and user perspective? But to provide resiliency, we need to deploy a multiple computer edge server, pool in each site with DNS load balancing. So then we've got no single point of failure, so, multiple servers in each side providing high availability for edge services. In the event of a primary site failing with edge servers in it, you may need to conduct some route modifications in Topology Builder. And this is from a federation perspective. So if you say edge pool in site one has failed and its next hop was the pool within that site and the pool's failed as well, then you need to make topology changes to change where the edge servers are pointing to in terms of next hop for pool. And then also global server load balancing is an option here. So if you've got something like that can make DNS changes for you publicly, then you could utilize this potentially to automatically fail over requests for your access edge FQDN to another server in another site. Okay, branch office resiliency. Things haven't changed too much here. We've still got the Survivor branch appliance, which provides local registrar and mediation services for voice in the event of WAN failover. And this is really scoped between 25 to 1,000 users. And then you've got the Survivable Branch Server plus Gateway, and that's 1,000 to 2,000 users. And the way you would do this from a voice policy perspective is configure failover voice routes. So like I said before with that question, is you'd say if in my branch site of, say, Hamburg, if the Hamburg gateway fails, in the voice policy assigned to those Hamburg users, specify a secondary gateway of, say, Berlin, so that if the Hamburg gateway goes down, they can still route out a existing available gateway elsewhere. And also the backup registrar functionality. So if my branch SBA fails, I can use the central services within the data center. And within Link 2013, the functionality is still many to one. So you can have many SBAs talking to one front-end pool. There is now this new remote branch appliance as well within Link 2013, and this provides you branch survivability using 3G or 4G failover. And I think it's quite cool, actually, so that if you've got completely, your WAN's gone, voice is gone completely, the remote branch appliance can fail over using the mobile network to reconnect into the Link environment, essentially. And there are also these SBA version 2 specifications that provide an appliance for under 25 users and support virtualization as well. So these are coming from some of the gateway vendors within the market. Now they're specking up these new models of their products. Cool. Okay, key takeaways from this session. Really, before you engage on your Link 2013 deployment, determine your HA requirements and say, how many sites do I have? How do I provide HA within each primary site? How do I do DR across to other sites within the same world region? What features am I providing HA and DR for? High availability in 2013 has stepped up a gear, SQL mirroring and pool pairing. There's only two things to take away from this session: SQL mirroring, pool pairing. Front-end architecture has changed radically, like I said, Windows Fabric, user groups, routing groups, RTC XDS database, all these things are massive changes within 2013. And there's more resiliency intelligence built right into the product. So we have a lot more visibility of what's going on from a resiliency perspective. We can see all the components within the environment now. And as I said, persistent chat has its own specific HA requirements that you need to take into consideration if you're today a heavy user or going to be a heavy user of PC. Okay, is there any questions that I can answer? I covered a lot of them during the session. Nope, okay. There's a bit of related content here. There's a book, Link Server 2013 Unleashed, that's out on the market today. They're selling it in the bookstore, I think. And I've got two copies to give away at the Link booth at some point, if you can come and have an in-depth technical conversation with me. So you can find me later at the Link booth or on Twitter at Justin Morris without the N. So hit me up, follow me. Got any questions, I'm more than happy to answer on Twitter or at the Link booth as well. And evaluate this session, please. It's really good to get your feedback and see what you think, how we can improve, that kind of thing. Okay, so with that, thank you very much for coming to my session.